We continue now with our Tales of the Hasidic Master, Stories of the Baal Shem Tov. Once came to pass that one of the Einiklach, one of the grandchildren of the Baal Shem Tov, was to be married. And the Mesaler Kedushin was to be the Tildes, Rabbi Yankov Yosef of Polnoa. The Baal Shem Tov was going to the wedding, and there were many, many Hasidim who followed him. On their way, they encountered an unfamiliar Jew who was traveling in a wagon. The Baal Shem Tov left those who were accompanying him, went over to the stranger, whispered a few words to him, and then took his place again in his own wagon. The members of the Chavrai Kadisha, the Holy Brotherhood, were wondering what took place, who was this individual, and among themselves they decided that surely this stranger was a hidden tzaddik, a tzaddik nister, possibly one of the Lamed Vov tzaddikim, one of the 36 tzaddikim upon whom the world stands. And they were very inquisitive and wanted very much to know just what was happening here. At the same time, it would not be derech eretz, it would not be respectful, nor would it be proper for them to leave the Baal Shem Tov and go over to this individual. So they mentioned to some of the younger Talmidim, you know, to some of the younger students that were further away, that they should find out who this man is and what this mysterious exchange was all about. Two young men promptly volunteered and followed the man in the wagon into the courtyard of one of the local inns. At this point, they approached him, and they greeted him with much respect and with due deference, and they said to him, Shalom Aleichem, Rabbi, an expression of respect which one uses when one speaks to the great. What's this talk of a Rebbe? Asked the stranger in wonderment. I'm not a Rebbe or the son of a Rebbe, and I'm quite far from anything like being a Rebbe. Sir, there's no point in trying to hide your identity any longer, these two Talmidim said. We know that you must be a tzaddik, for after all, the Baal Shem Tov himself stopped, and he went over to you, and he spoke to you. Please tell us who you are, and maybe if we merit, you can tell us what the conversation was about. The poor fellow had no idea what they were talking about, and gave them his word of honor that at no time in his life had he ever been a tzaddik or a rebbe. Nevertheless, the Talmidim assured him that since their rebbe had approached him, since the Baal Shem Tov had approached him and spoken to him, as soon as he saw him, surely he was some tzaddik nister, and they would give him no rest until he revealed his true identity and spoke to them in the manner that tzaddikim may be expected to speak, and so they would hear words of wisdom from him, and once again, if at all possible, what the conversation with the Baal Shem Tov was all about. The man, when he saw that he wouldn't be able to get rid of him, said, first of all, I want you fellows to know that I am a plain, simple, ordinary Jew. I am not a rabbi. But since you're so persistent and you keep on nudging me, I see that I have no option left but to tell you what the Baal Shem Tov said to me. And in the meantime, as I tell you the story, you'll see what a truly great man the Baal Shem Tov is. So listen closely and here's my story. And the man told these two young men the following story. I live in a little village over the road from my friend. Since childhood, we've been like brothers. There are no secrets between us, and each of us shares in the other's joys as well as in the other's woes. My friend buys up various products such as flax, honey, wax, and other produce from the villagers all around. And then he takes it to the city to be sold. With the profits he brings home, he pays up his debts, leaving some money for his family to live on, and sets out on another round, and so he does time and time again, and this is how he earns his living. On one of these occasions, when my friend returned from the city with his earnings, all of his friends and relatives dropped into his home to greet him, as was always the custom when he would be away for a while, and they came to join in the joy of his family on his return. I was there too, of course. I felt like smoking, and since we always made ourselves completely at home in each other's house, I went straight to the cupboard where he kept his tobacco. As soon as I opened the cupboard door, I saw the wallet of money that my friend had brought back from his long journey. His carelessness amazed me. How does somebody leave such a sum of money almost out in the open, not concealed from anybody, where it can be taken by anyone? I decided that I would have to teach him not to leave such valuables in a place which is so accessible to all. And so I decided to quietly take his wallet so that he would be shaken up when he saw that it was missing. And then, having been shaken and realizing that it is easily taken from that place, I would return it to him. That would certainly teach him to take more care with his valuables. I did exactly that and took the wallet home with the intention of returning it after an hour or so. When the poor man opened the cupboard, he was alarmed. The wallet was not there. He asked his wife whether she had put it away someplace else. She, of course, was as dumbfounded as he was. And soon the entire household was in turmoil. The house was turned inside out. But of course, since I had taken the wallet, they found nothing. Hearing the whole hubbub and tumult, the neighbors began running in. And the more people shared in their panic, the greater it grew, until my friend fainted. Not only did he faint, his wife as well, and their children ran around desperately, crying at the top of their voices. When I heard all this uproar coming from my friend's house over the road, I figured what was all caused by, that it was because I took the wallet to teach him the lesson. And so I went straight across in order to return the lost property. But as soon as I walked inside and saw the whole tumult, I couldn't bring myself to own up to it right then and there, in the presence of all those friends and relatives that I had taken the money. Go explain to them that this was my dear friend, and this was to be an object lesson that he not leave it in such an open place. The best thing, I thought to myself, would be to wait a little until they all went home. And then, when the two of us, I and my friend, were left alone, then I would return him his wallet and explain why I took it and ask his forgiveness for having caused such pain. But you know how news of any calamity spreads like wildfire through a shtetl, where everyone knows everybody else. The house filled up more and more, and instead of people leaving, it became more and more full. And the greater the pandemonium, the harder it was for me to say I was the one who did it. If I had returned the wallet as soon as I had come in, people would have accused me of causing my friend all that anguish, but nothing more than that. Nobody would have suspected me of stealing, God forbid. But if I had come forward at this point, now that hours had gone by, and the whole town was abuzz with shock and indignation about the damage that had supposedly been done, people would have suspected that my original intention had in fact been to steal the wallet, and that now, because I could not bear the sight of what was going on, I had changed my mind and decided to return it after all. So very late at night, I went home, and I cried tears of despair. My family, of course, knew nothing about my taking the wallet, and they assumed that I was simply upset at the misfortune that had struck my best friend. And upset I certainly was, for I knew that it was I who had caused all that misery and mess, but I didn't know how to extricate myself from it. It seemed to be a situation from which there seemed to be no way of getting out of it. More serious complications began the next day. My friend had dozens of creditors, and they began to suspect that he had staged the theft in order to evade their claims. They started speaking in whispers, but then they began speaking openly, until finally they walked into his kitchen, banged on the table, and shouted, "Cheat! Robber! We want our money!" And the more complicated the story became, the man said, the harder it was for me to return the money. Several days dragged by. And now the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, stepped into the picture. And he said to me, "You can see with your own eyes that you have absolutely no possibility of returning the money now. Why not, for the time being, use it for yourself? Invest it somehow. Make some profit on it. And in the course of time, you'll surely think up some means of returning it to your friend." I was beginning to find this argument most convincing. The problem was that in my hometown, I couldn't possibly do any business that required considerable capital, because everyone would start suspecting me, because they knew that here I am, a person who's quite far from being wealthy, and all of a sudden, I'm doing business, and where's the money? These must be ill-gotten gains. Up until this time, nobody, of course, suspected me, and even my family had no idea what I had done. But if suddenly I started throwing around money in large sums, then the people may turn to me and think that maybe I took it. Once again, the evil inclination came to my aid and said, "Why not go someplace far away? First you go alone, start a business there, and later bring your family. Nobody would know that far away from your hometown whether you had money or not, and whether you became rich or not in the other place. And even if they found out after some time that you became wealthy, they would assume that business was looking up and you had struck it rich and things had gone finally well with you, and you'll be able to come by it. And besides, once you're well established in a far off town," the Yetzer Hara said to me, "surely you wouldn't take to heart what the former townsmen would say about you behind your back, even if they would talk about you. So what's the big deal? Why not do it?" So the man continued his story to the two disciples and said, "So I hired a horse and a wagon, and off I went. I let out word that I was going to try my luck wherever I happened to find it, in a job or a business or whatever, because the people knew that I was having a hard time at home with a livelihood. And even my family knows no more than that. That's all they know, that I'm trying to seek my fortune. And just now, half an hour ago, I met your Rebbe, the Baal Shem Tov, and all the people apparently on your way to a wedding. And as soon as he saw me, and believe me, your Rebbe has never in his life laid eyes on me before, he came across to me and said, and I was astonished, and he says to me, 'My dear friend, take my advice. Go back home and return the money to your neighbor. I promise you that I will personally appear before the Besdin, before the rabbinical court in your hometown, and testify that you had no evil intentions when you took the money from your friend. You merely wanted him to learn a lesson.'" And now the stranger heaved a sigh as he neared the end of his story. "I feel as if a heavy stone has been rolled off my heart. I'm going now to return straight home with Hashem's help. I'll give my friend his money, the creditors will get theirs, and the Baal Shem Tov will no doubt fulfill his promise and testify before the court that when I took the wallet, I was acting in good faith. You'll see, everything will work out well now in the end, after all. The spirit of the story, which was just told about somebody taking money that was not his, there's another story along these lines, although not with the Baal Shem Tov. In the city of Leipzig, there lived a Jew by the name of Yossel, who earned a meager livelihood by peddling merchandise among the surrounding villages. As he was preparing one day to set out with his humble wares, he saw how downcast his wife looked, and asked her what was bothering her. "Look, Yossel," she said, "things with us are pretty bleak. Even the most basic necessities are missing. That's what's bothering me." "Don't worry," Yossel assured his wife. "Eliyahu HaNavi, who has blessed so many people, can bless us too." And off Yossel went. On the way out of town, he met the mail coach on its way towards Leipzig. And just as it passed him, he saw that two envelopes fell out of the coach. Picking them up, he saw that one of them was marked with the information that it contained 30,000 marks in cash, and it was to be delivered to some squire or other whose address was written there. The other was a perfectly ordinary addressed envelope. Without thinking much, Yossel popped the fat cash envelope into his pocket, and at the top of his voice shouted out to the coach driver that he had dropped something. The mailman heard him and returned, thanked Yossel for the plain envelope, and continued on his way. Not so Yossel. Instead of continuing towards the villages, he now turned around and headed for home. By way of answer to his wife's wide-eyed surprise at seeing him as so soon, he said, "Well, what did I tell you? Hashem has already sent his blessings." He told his wife the whole story. His wife was flabbergasted. "How could you have done such a thing? Don't you realize that it's plain and simple robbery? Are we suddenly going to become thieves?" Yossel tried to calm her. "First place, the addressee isn't one of us. Secondly, he won't suffer any loss anyway, because the post office will have to pay him. And that belongs to the government, not to a private individual. So what's all the noise about?" "Look here, Yossel," his wife said. "I'm just a plain, ordinary housewife, and I don't know from clever words and fancy talk. All I know is that the money isn't ours, and we're not allowed to use somebody else's. What will our children say when they wake up tomorrow morning and find out all of a sudden that their parents are thieves?" But when she saw that all her words had absolutely no effect on her husband, who was listening to all her rebukes in relaxed tranquility and obviously was not even considering the possibility of returning his fine, she tried another tack. "The people from the government will come and search through our house for sure, because the mailman knows you found one letter and will guess that you found the other one as well." Now, this was an argument which was more convincing. Yossel got up quickly, moved the wardrobe from its corner, tore up one of the floorboards, hid the envelope under it, returned the plank, and pushed the wardrobe safely back into place. Sure enough, only a few hours later, they had two callers, the police and the mailman. They cross-examined Yossel as thoroughly as they could, and he stoutly denied having seen any envelope apart from the one which he had so faithfully returned. His wife sat in silence. She was certainly bitterly disappointed with this husband of hers. But she could not mention this, of course, to the visitors. After an unsuccessful search of the house, the policeman renewed this cross-examination until the mailman spoke up. "Look," he said, "the letter which he found he passed on to me at once, which surely means that he found nothing else. Just because he's an honest man and returned me the letter that he found, does that mean that we should suspect him without cause?" Unexpectedly, the policeman flared up at these words and turned on the mailman. "So you're putting in a good word for him, are you? It's obvious that this is a carefully planned inside job. I'll have to arrest the two of you." And so Yossel was hauled off to jail. Word spread fast enough, and since the townsfolk all knew him as a simple, honest peddler, they assumed that Yossel was the innocent victim of a vicious libel, and everybody expressed sympathy to the wife, and they bought her food and drink. and so on. In the meantime, the postal authorities plastered the city with notices. Whoever returned the lost envelope to the post office would receive a rich reward of 500 rubles. Not surprisingly, the reward remained without a claimant. One day, the resourceful woman came up with a plan. She would take the bundle of notes to the local Rav, and he, in his wisdom, would devise some means of returning it to the post office. In this way, the whole matter would be dropped, and her yossel would be freed. No sooner thought than done. She dragged the wardrobe from its corner, pulled up the floorboard, took out the envelope, and walked quickly to the home of the local Rav, who was a celebrated Rav Baruch Frankel Toyamim, the father-in-law of Rav Chaim Tzanzer. As she approached the rabbi's house, however, she saw through the window that he was in the midst of teaching a group of Talmid Chacham. She could hardly bring herself to walk in and confess the whole truth in the presence of a number of people, so she saved the situation simply. She threw the envelope through the open window into the rabbi's study, and promptly and anonymously left the scene. The rabbi picked up the flying object and, to his amazement, identified it as a flat envelope with 30,000 marks written on it. This must clearly be the lost item that poor innocent Yossel was imprisoned over. But who was the individual who had thrown it in incognito, and why had he not returned it to its proper address, the post office? Now, this is a tricky business, thought the rabbi. I'll have to consider my steps very carefully indeed. If I go straight to the post office and return the money, he told himself, that will only cause a chilul Hashem. Who would ever believe such an alibi that an anonymous stranger threw the object through the open window of the local rabbi's study? They will assume that the rabbi, together with his community, originally planned to lay hands on the government's money, but later changed their mind for some reason. And as he was thinking, in the meantime, he deposited the envelope in his drawer and locked it, and went out to stroll. That way he would have a clear mind to be able to think his way out of the dilemma. When he was only a short distance from his home, he thought to himself, now that wasn't very clever of me locking the envelope up in the drawer. Who knows? Perhaps it was thrown into my house by some anti-Semite as a libel. The money has got to be gotten right away and found on the floor where it landed. Any policeman who comes to search the house will realize that no thief leaves his loot lying around on the floor. With that, the Baruch went back, took the envelope out of the drawer, put it on the floor, and resumed his stroll. On and on he walked, turning over all the possibilities in his mind, until he found that he was on the outskirts of the city. There he was subtly greeted by the bishop of Leipzig, who was out on his daily walk. The bishop had always respected the Baruch as a learned and holy man, and now asked him what made him look so preoccupied. A novel idea flickered in the rabbi's mind. Could you please tell me, Rav Baruch asked the bishop, whether you are obliged to keep in strict confidence whatever you are told in confession? Most certainly, said the cleric. Secrets from such a source are divulged to no man. Another question, continued the rabbi. Are you permitted to receive confessions from persons who are not of your faith? I am indeed. In that case, said Rav Baruch, I would like to make confession to you, on condition that this take place in your home, and not in your place of worship. The bishop was dumbstruck. The rabbi was coming to him for confession. But when he saw that this was no joking matter, and the rabbi was speaking in perfect seriousness, he answered that at home, too, he kept a special chair for confessions. I'm afraid not, said the rabbi. I could really do without a special chair. What I had in mind was that we should both sit together on ordinary chairs next to the table, and there I would give you my confession. The bishop was at loss for a moment. Reverend sir, he said, I must point out that ecclesiastical statutes are ecclesiastical statutes. Then he thought the better of it, and decided that out of deference for the rabbi, he could allow an episcopal dispensation in this case and suspend the conventional forms. He would receive the rabbi's confession without any of the trappings of churchly ceremonial. Very well, said the rabbi. Let's go home, and in about an hour I'll call on you at your residence. He went home to collect the envelope and took it to the bishop, who received it, Rav Baruch, with all the politest marks of respect. It was now time to tell the bishop the whole story. When he concluded the story, Rav Baruch explained his dilemma and his fears, and requested that the cleric take the money from his hands, pass it on to the postal authorities, and tell them that someone had given it to him during confession. Under these circumstances, no questions would be asked. The bishop listened carefully and consented. The next day, the whole of Leipzig was agog with exciting news. news. The money had been found, and Yossel was free. The innocent little man had been arrested for nothing. Overjoyed at his unexplained good fortune, Yossel yet had to face a tribunal of a different sort. As soon as he came home, his wife told him how she had thrown the envelope into the house of the Rav, who, being such a righteous and holy man, had immediately passed it on to the postal authorities in order that he, Yossel, be freed. In which case, she concluded, the right thing for you to do now is to go along to the Rav to thank him and to tell him the entire truth. He had no option but to agree, and off he went to do his duty. As soon as the Rav laid eyes on him, he uttered the bracha of Matar Asudim, praising Hashem who frees the bound, and his heart swelling with honest sentiments expressed his joy that one so innocent and so righteous as Yossel had at last been saved from such a foul miscarriage of justice. No, Rabbi, no, Yossel insisted. I am neither innocent nor righteous. I am a sinner. And the unwilling martyr told his whole story, expressing as well as profound regret what he had done. And the Rav, for his part, did his best to console him with the thought that the wrong had at least been rectified. At this point, they were joined by the bishop, who had come to pass on to the rabbi the reward of 500 gold rubles that he had received from the postal authorities. The rabbi refused to accept the money. You are the one who deserves it, he said, for your trouble in conveying the envelope to its rightful owner. Moreover, I am deeply indebted to you for getting me out of such a fix. The bishop was not readily convinced. No, he said, the reward is not due to me because I did not find the money. And if indeed you refuse to accept the 500 rubles for yourself, you might perhaps like to distribute it instead among the poor. Even that, said the Rav, is your prerogative, for it is you who did a good deed. In the course of this discussion, the Rav suddenly recalled Yossel. Look here, my friend, he said to the bishop. Here before us stands Yossel. He is the innocent victim of this whole unpleasant affair, and he is poor into the bargain. Wouldn't it be proper to give him the reward? The bishop was much impressed with the rabbi's ingenuity. How is it that this didn't occur to me until now, he thought. Yossel was at first unwilling, not seeing himself as exactly deserving of a reward. But the Rav insisted that he accept it and use it to open a shop. He even undertook to send him customers. And so it was that Yossel took the reward, opened the business, prospered exceedingly, and gave charity with an open hand to all comers until the end of his days, and, as we say, lived happily ever after.